Hi, I'm Ken.
And I'm Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Now in high def. Maybe.
Coming at you from two microphones with what topic?
Today we're going to be talking about that down-home country flair, yellowware. I thought of that on the fly. I did not intend to do that.
So this is the episode you wished you were recording throughout our Spatterware versus Spongeware episode?
Did I say that? Yes.
Yes.
In short, yes it is.
Let us fulfill your dream.
All right. Well, okay, so yellowware, much like Spatterware and Spongeware, which I desperately wish to not be doing. just kidding, I like them. Yellowware is also pottery. It's an earthenware pottery that gets its name from... Ken, I want you to guess what it gets its name from.
The color of the glaze and or the color of the clay. I am split between the two.
The clay.
Shit.
And that's key. The yellowware refers strictly to the color of the clay itself.
Oh.
In fact, there are yellowware pieces that are not even yellow.
Plot twist.
Plot twist. You didn't see that coming. I'm like, this is like Kaiser Soze? More like Kaiser...
Are you trying to remember the German word for yellow?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I can't help you.
Anyway, now that I've Kaiser Soze'd you. Yeah, so that's the most important part about yellowware. And I think it's the most misunderstood because I think a lot of people see yellow pottery and say, oh, that's yellowware? Not so. First pieces of yellowware were actually made in Scotland and England. Big surprise, you can see a lot of like weird contention where England is continually claiming to have like invented yellowware. It was Scotland in the 1600s. and England copied Scotland like they do. And it started using these yellow clays that were anywhere from mustard to buff. The thing about the yellow clay that they found out pretty quickly is that it vitrified at a much higher temperature.
What is vitrification?
Vitrification is when it hardens. That is the process through which heat hardens clay.
I am trying to draw parallels to the vitreous humors of the eye, but as far as I know, the vitreous humors of the eye do not harden.
I would not draw those parallels because I cannot help you through this journey. All I know is what vitrification means in pottery.
Parallels canceled.
This is because it doesn't have as much iron. And what this means, practically for the clay, is that the yellow clay is stronger and lighter than redware, and it's cheaper and easier to do than a lot of harder clays. So you can see how this took off pretty quickly as like a workhorse clay. Eventually, in the 18th century, the UK was the best known for yellow clay, until after the 1850s, when yellowware clay had moved over to America, got taken over by Ohio. You may notice if you're into pottery, that Ohio comes up a lot when you're talking about pottery. There are lots of rich river deltas that create a lot of different clays. This was not different for the yellow clay that made yellowware famous. It's actually said that between 1865 and 1885, Ohio alone produced half of America's yellowware.
Fuck.
Yeah. Although other rich areas were Maryland and New Jersey, which you may also notice are states with rivers in them. But yeah, Ohio was the giant.
Sorry, I'm still not over states with rivers in them.
States with rivers in them. My new podcast, by the way, this is viral advertising for my podcast, States That Also Have Rivers Going in Them. So yeah, after that, the U.S. would take over yellowware production, with a lot of it concentrated in Ohio and generally those big river states.
Those big river states. Montana may be big sky country, but it's not big river country.
And it's certainly not big clay country. Come at me. So, especially in the U.S., which has historically not been quite as, let's say, rich as the Europeans.
In terms of river clay?
In terms of the proletariat
concentration.
The U.S. took a really long time to develop an upper class. Like, it wasn't until the Gilded Era that we really had one.
Gotcha.
So, yellowware was omnipresent in the U.S. for a very long time, actually up until about the 1920s, when Pyrex glass and plastic started coming around. And it's really, like a lot of things that started originally in Europe, and then we immediately cut Europe out of the equation, it's considered a very classically American antique. Here's the thing. It's not even remotely in my general purview. I love it. I love yellowware. I don't know what it is about it. It's so cozy. My grandmother never used any of it, but it makes me think of grandmothers. Not mine, but someone's. So what did Yellowware look like, you ask? Yellow. Next question.
You just said. Hang on. I have it on good authority from someone with 14 years of experience in the antiques industry that Yellowware is not necessarily yellow.
No, it was a bit.
Oh.
It was a bit.
Comedy. I remember.
So commonly Yellowware is just almost always glazed, and a lot of it is just a clear glaze over the yellow clay. Sometimes it's glazed alongside other colors. This is most of the time in banding and stripes. And you'll see that with white, green, blue, brown. I believe that is called annular ware, is any banded yellow ware. Later on, particularly McCoy and Weller would make these yellow ware pieces that were glazed in a pretty heavy green where you can just barely see the clay underneath. You can identify it by the underside, where you can see the original raw clay. This is still yellowware, even though it is almost entirely green. Less often, this isn't really attributed to any particular companies. You could see it glazed in pure white, like a really heavy leaden white. Get to that in a second. there is a spongeware variant of yellowware called Rockingham, which is specifically spongeware modeled in brown glaze, or slip. I do feel the need, now that I've introduced slip and glaze. Slip is a colored, like, wet clay that's applied to clay before firing, and glaze is a glaze after bisque firing and before final glaze firing. The qualities of the color are different, and I would be remiss in not pointing out the difference between the two. Yellowware can be colored with either. And there's also, I find this really interesting, mocha decoration. Usually there is a broad white band on the yellowware that will have some kind of generally naturalistic, I'm going to say design here, although it, like, we're talking a pretty abstract concept of design, but you see like seaweed, trees, feathers, worms, grass. Mocha designs are tobacco mixed with turpentine and stale urine.
So I'm guessing pottery innovators had a lot of time on their hands.
They sure did. So the trick to this is that you would use turpentine, tobacco, and piss, and you would apply it to the band of white slip, and when fired, it kind of ink blotted out. So, which is why I say, like, an abstract approach to a design, it will resemble these things, and it may be applied in the shape of these things, but as it's fired, it does kind of change. I've only seen a tree and a seaweed of it personally, and those are what I'm going to call loose interpretations of the shapes that happened.
Life hack: recycle your piss with this one weird trick.
One weird trick discovered by a piss. other designs will include molding, carving, banding, floral or natural or scenic. Almost all of those are associated with molding processes of various types. And since one thing I can tell you about yellowware is that it's incredibly hard to date, when we're talking about a lot of antiques that are considered, oh, let's just call them poor person antiques. Like workhorse, ubiquitous antiques are all notoriously really hard to date because a lot of people didn't bother marking them.
They also have, like, massive trust issues.
They have so many trust issues. And, like, it's come to a point where they can't commit.
They are absolutely incapable of emotional intimacy.
They are not incapable. It's difficult for them.
Sounds like someone's been swiping right on a lot of yellowware.
Listen. But so a lot of these design elements can kind of point you in the direction of the age of a piece if it's not marked. And let's face it, it won't be. So you get things like a combination of white and brown slip decorations are mid-1800s. Decorations in all kinds of colored slip past white and brown, later 1800s, so past 1850. Pale blue and brown rings in concert with each other, early 20th century. One of the biggest ones are the lip of the on bowls and other like round open vessels. A chunky collared geometric lip with heavy molding is like early 20th century to mid 20th century. In the earlier 1800s to the mid 1800s, you get a thin rolled lip. And that is probably the most distinctive and easy age differential to make. You might notice that none of these are specific That's it. That's how that cookie crumbles. Sorry. A combination of white, blue, and brown bands, anywhere from 1840 to 1900. Food molds in general tend to be older, because after a certain point in the 20th century, molding food just wasn't a thing we did anymore. Mold markings, which is to say lines generally in twos or threes, they tend to mean that it's well past the mid-1800s, when molding technologies became easier and faster. You know, other than that, you can look at design elements if they're stamped or molded, and, you know, geometrics we tend to associate with the 1910s or the 1930s. Yeah, that's not especially helpful, I know. Florals are, like, late 1800s. Scenics are, like, 1920s. Starbursts, sunbursts. A lot of it requires being familiar with design elements of the times, which, I granted, isn't incredibly... That's, like, a lot to ask of a single human being who just wants to collect cute pottery. I need you to associate yourself with every art movement from 1800 to 1950. But it will help if you are. Because once you're familiar with them looking at these designs, you can kind of say, that's 1930s, I can feel it in my art bones.
One, I appreciate how you gestured at my Ouija board mug when you said, that's 1930s. But two, I'm also thrilled that we finally found a use for art school.
Honest to God, when I got out of art school, I was thrilled. I was like, at least I can do something with this. But I will also confess it might be a chicken or egg thing because I did very well in art history because I had been working in antiques for so long. So I don't know. And yes, your mug is decidedly 1930s design despite the heavy use of rounds and scroll work.
Damn, dog.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah. It'd be like that. So now that you've heard about yellowware and you've probably Googled yellowware and you're like, oh, I love it. Martha Stewart has like 20 articles on it. None of them particularly helpful.
Hashtag thanks, Martha.
Coming for you. You want it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course you do. Okay, so first thing, I did promise I'd come back to this later. The glaze is leaded.
That might be an issue.
It is what you would call a minor issue. It is not as dangerous as, say, leaded crystal. But you definitely don't want to store anything in them long term. You don't want to use ones that have big cracks. And you really, really don't want to store them in the refrigerator with food or anything that might be acidic. There's a certain level of resistance that the glaze has to leaching, and all those things I mentioned will encourage leaching.
But I can throw it in the dishwasher, right?
Absolutely not! How dare you? Most of them come with damage already. This is why they're so hard to date. That's because they're work pieces. Nobody had them on display up until about the 2000s. And actually, most of the people I know who collect it do still use it. They're really fabulous. If you need to use it for food molding, for mixing, you know, if that's your prerogative, that's great. Like I said, it's mostly an issue of storage and damaged pieces. And so that would be my advice for avoiding lead poisoning.
For more tips, check out our episode, Danger, Lead Poisoning.
Yeah, please. Please. Don't get lead poisoning. So other than that, now that you know how it's safe to use it, don't put it in the dishwasher. It's still an antique pottery. How can you tell if it's old or real or gay? Ken has this faraway look as if he's trying to figure out how to tell how he knows the pottery is gay.
I mean, not to stereotype, but I feel like in antiques, default is gay.
That is true. We do not do heteronormativity in antiques. No matter what the heteros in antiques will tell you. Shout out to all my heteros in antiques. We still love you.
Love you.
Just don't think that you're the norm here.
Whoa. Whoa.
You're welcome in our community, but you're not our standard.
Jesus.
Stop making that noise. I have to keep dialing back.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, heterosexuals.
You know why I make that noise? It's because you need to dial back. This is why evolution has developed this noise in me.
This is great. This is going to make a great deleted scene.
Fucking heterophobia over here.
So, as for old and real pieces, because, you know, big warning, like a lot of cute, quaint, kitschy kitchen wares, they are pretty heavily reproduced. This one I actually find more than other potteries is it gets easier with like handling to tell when things are old. They have an incredibly distinctive like weight and heft and appearance to them. A lot of the new ones, they use tinted glazing instead of yellow clay. Because finding a specific yellow clay and firing it at the right temperatures, that's hard. That requires effort. People who are doing reproductions can't do that. So they tend to use a heavily colored clay. More clever ones will use a colored slip and then glaze over that, which can be harder. But there's a quality to it that is heavy and painted that when you compare it to an actual clay piece, is pretty easy to tell the difference between. One of the hardest things to do is to create a tint that replicates nature. And most people aren't very good at it. And people who are mass producing things are especially not good at it. So, you know, you pull up some pictures of genuine yellowware and compare it to the colors, and you'll get a sense that something's off, and I would be suspicious at that point. Other things than that are the weight. The reproductions tend to be very light. Just very light. They don't have the heft, the weight, and, like, the thickness of a proper yellowware piece. They tend to be sloppily done. If there are, like, molded or incised markings, they're faint. They're difficult to read. They kind of seem like an afterthought. A lot of times they just don't use yellow clay. I'm going to keep coming back to that because it's a big one. And you can just flip that baby over and see the color of the clay on the ring underneath 90% of the time. So that's going to be an easy one for you. If it's white clay, it's not yellowware. Like, one thing, I looked at a bunch of fakes to train myself for this moment. And the banding, which are some of the more charming pieces and the ones that get reproduced, are the ones with the colored banding. The banding is always very bad. Always very bad, even if it's like a slip banding like the originals or a glaze banding. The colors are way too vibrant. They're like weirdly crisp at the edges in a way that you wouldn't see in an antique piece. Everything about it looks like it's trying too hard. And this isn't even like you need years of experience. If you look at one real yellowware bowl and then compare it to like the banding on a new one, you're like, oh no, I got it. That one's easy. And just the colors. Colors should always be faint. You should always keep in mind the nature of tinting in the antique world. There's a level of vibrancy that you can learn to identify as way too modern. Like, blues should never be like an electric blue. It's always like a soft and translucent. That's what you're looking for. Soft, translucent quality to the colors. If you want to see if it's old, you can go to crazing. A lot of the reproduced pieces are fake crazed. That is a matter of consistency. Fake crazing is too consistent and not random enough. I hope that covers it.
We're just crazy about crazing.
I'm crazy about... Well, crazing is one of the most useful things when it comes to pottery. But yeah, you're looking for an uneven crazing.
You are looking for uneven small cracks beneath the glaze of the pottery.
Thank you. Like a lot of pottery, I hope you guys aren't getting tired of this yet if you're a return customer to any of our pottery episodes. You look on the underside, there should be either an unglazed bottom ring, or if it's glazed, there are three little pinpricks where it was set to dry. With these pieces, you're looking for way more unglazed because these are utilitarian pieces that aren't made with like a lot of care. You're looking for heft and weight. Yellowware is considerably heftier than most potteries. It's not quite as heavy as an ironware. It again has like a very significant heft and weight that outsizes its actual size. Like any antique that is original that has been reproduced, you're looking for fine, precise, and quality detail on molding and incisions and slip applications even. Like I just said, natural quality of colors, nothing too bright. And you can check for markings. I wouldn't get your hopes up. And if you find markings, that actually increases the value quite a bit. Hull, McCoy, Bennington, and Weller are really the most common you'll run into. And some of the only ones that ever get marked after a certain point. And like I said, that will increase the value because it makes it easier to track and date. Other things that'll up the value are sets of nesting bowls. This is huge. Yellowware nesting bowls are like, I think, one of the most common things everyone's after. And you almost always have to cobble it together yourself, which I think is a really special experience. I have two sets of Fire King bowls that I put together myself over a span of 10 years. And now I'm attached to them and I'll never sell them, which is a shame. But for yellowware bowls, you gotta keep in mind, the biggest and the smallest are always the hardest to find. So when you have a complete set with those, you are in da money. Other things that control value are decoration, mostly. Again, age... The older pieces, the mold pieces are really valuable. But the beautiful thing about this is that yellowware is not necessarily an expensive thing to get into. A lot of really cute pieces that are still very utilitarian, I've seen a lot of them span from $5 to $40. And going up is pretty much just, like, if you don't want to become a collector but you still want some, this is a great antique to get into. Because the high prices are just collector pieces.
Right on.
Right on. Do you feel warm, cozy, ready to bake?
Yeah.
All right. Let's get some yellowware. Sources for today include noyellowware.com, very disappointed. But we do have adirondackgirlatheart.com.
Sure.
Shout out to her. Collecting antique yellowware pottery. Ourpastimes.com article, identify old antique yellowware. SunSentinel.com, just type in yellowware. Just SunSentinel.com, they have an article on collecting yellowware. It's great. And collectorsweekly.com/kitchen/bowls. And our perennial best friend, Wikipedia.
Please donate.
Please donate, won't you?
Thank you. If you would like to show us your yellowware, you can email us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com.
Please do. I love yellowware.
Or you can hit up our Facebook at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks and join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, where you can share those yellowware photos with everybody.
Yeah. Do you want online validation? Here it comes.
Woo!
I'm about to click that little heart on your yellowware.
If you want more people to hear about yellowware and also antiques, on this podcast especially, you can go down to your podcasting app and leave a review.
I prefer a 5-star review. I know Ken is at odds with me about this.
Any review helps. You don't have to enjoy it.
In fact, sometimes the really bad reviews are very funny to read. So you know what? Like, go nuts.
Speaking of great 5-star reviews.
Oh boy.
We have one from Floofy B. 5 stars. More horse, please.
Well, Floofy B, I think we're in a position to really gratify that request.
Tune in. More horse.
More horse, please.
We also have a review from Hippie Mom. Loving the podcast. I will warn folks that it's not super kid friendly. My 4-year-old just asked me what a goddamn Beanie Baby was.
I'm really sorry about that, Hippie Mom. Sorry about the goddamn Beanie Babies.
We have certainly earned that explicit tag.
I'm so sorry. Hippie Mom, you're a real one.
And finally, a review titled Not for the Faint of Heart, which is what I love about
it. That's such a bold statement. I love that.
From Sterling Sleuth, who concludes that my pals at the antique mall will have to hang on to their pacemakers.
Please don't kill anyone in introducing them to our podcast.
No children and nobody on heart medication. But aside from that, we're good.
Yeah, other than that, we're and probably not the French either, I guess.
I have said several terrible things about the French.
Yeah.
Which makes things a bit awkward with the French. If you would like to hear more terrible things about the French, you can check out deleted scenes posted on our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks, where we also have the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, where we send you a random vintage postcard every month.
And the postcard is guaranteed to say nothing unpleasant about the French. Okay, I can't guarantee because some of them are written on and I don't read them too carefully. It's guaranteed that neither Ken nor I are going to say anything unpleasant about the French.
There we go. Special shout out to our current patrons for paying our hosting fees and enabling us to get the 2 microphones we use to record this podcast.
And the mixers we use to deal with the 2 tracks from both pod microphones. Yeah, it's great. I hope that we sound good.
Our next goal is releasing bonus episodes, which, yes, does mean more horse.
I think it means a lot more horse.
More horse, more Ripper Street, more everything, really.
Yeah.
And thank you, in particular, for listening.
And your horse.
Goodbye.
Bye.